William F. Buckley Jr. died this morning at his desk at his home in Connecticut. Bill Buckley was both an intellectual and cultural force in American life, well known as a television host and a novelist, but best remembered as the acknowledged father of modern American conservatism. In a few moments, we'll take your calls on the life and influence of William Buckley. 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. In his last appearance on this program in 2004, he spoke about the foundation of his magazine, The National Review, in 1955.
Well, it was during the high days of President Eisenhower. He had defeated Senator Taft in 1952, and Senator Taft died a few months after Eisenhower was inaugurated. And there was a kind of placidity attaching to Eisenhower, which not only, in our judgment, affected the mood, the sort of silent 50s mood, but also affected policy. The anti-communist crystallization hadn't really happened. It was kind of lazy and untargeted. So we had, for instance, the Hungarian uprising without any effective protest. So in the late 50s, when National Review was born, there were a lot of people who wanted something to read that was well-informed and staunchly and unapologetically anti-communist and anti-socialist. And National Review did that.
The magazine was nothing if not controversial. Buckley defended Senator Joseph McCarthy and supported segregationists who argued that blacks should be denied the vote. He later suggested that the uneducated black and white should be barred from the polls. But he also championed not just anti-communism, as he mentioned, but lower taxes, less government, and the benefits of freedom to a small but always influential readership.
I knew that it would have an appeal to people who were looking for more crystalline waters, and it did. Barry Goldwater was attracted to it very early, and Ronald Reagan was a subscriber even when he was still nominally a Democrat. So that we felt very early on in the life of National Review that we were wired in to people who were politically active on the larger scale, and indeed we were. And of course, it was wonderfully gratifying when President Reagan, as president, appeared at the National Review celebration and said that National Review was primarily responsible for his political development. That was very gratifying. I wish he had been there.
And again, if you'd like to call with a story about the late William F. Buckley, our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Joining us now is William Crystal, editor of the Weekly Standard and a columnist for the New York Times. He joins us by phone from Fort Myers in Florida. And Bill Crystal, nice to talk with you again.
Good talking to you.
And I wonder, do you remember the first time you picked up a copy of the National Review?
I think I read it as a kid in the 60s at my parents' home. They got it. They were then still more on the liberals, well, moderate liberals, but had a high regard for National Review, and I remember enjoying it as a kid because partly because I agreed with much of it, not all of it perhaps, and partly because it was so lively and high-spirited and sort of fun-loving. You know, conservatives had been thought of as dour and sort of pessimistic types, and Buckley really changed, among the many, many things he did, one was to really change that aspect of conservatism.
And again, agree, disagree with his positions. There was always that glint in his eye of the mischievous boy.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you can't underestimate, in terms of conservatism's appeal, back in the 60s, 70s, and even after that, the degree to which it was fun being a rebel against liberal orthodoxy. And occasionally it led some conservatives to say things and take positions that perhaps were ill-advised in retrospect or even at the time. But there was such a sort of somewhat stifling orthodoxy, I guess there always is in most societies, and a kind of earnestness and preachiness often to liberalism. Some of it was was in good causes, to be fair, but still being a kind of a troublemaker was fun. But I really think you can't underestimate Buckley's influence. I mean, before Buckley, there was nothing. There was no conservative movement. There were individual conservative thinkers, many of them very interesting, but they weren't brought together in any way. And Buckley, personally, because of his just magnetism, really, and of course, National Review, the magazine that he founded and edited for so many years, created the conservative movement, the American conservative movement, as the clip you played suggests. They discovered Goldwater and recruited him to run for president. And, of course, more importantly, historically, they ended up providing a lot of the background, really, and infrastructure, you might almost intellectual infrastructure, for Ronald Reagan. You know, I do think someone once said, no Bill Buckley, no Ronald Reagan, and I really believe that.
All of, not just Ronald Reagan himself, but all of the thousands of true believers who filled important positions in his administration and in his campaigns.
Right. I mean, you'd run into young people. I came down to Washington in the mid-'80s to work in the Reagan administration, and you'd meet people, and they came from diverse strands of conservatism. There were religious conservatives, secular, free market conservatives, and traditionalists. But almost all of them had, more often than not, read National Review, been influenced by National Review, influenced by Buckley directly or indirectly.
And he was not just content to rest on the laurels of that, and was constantly pushing the movement different ways. And he was a prickly man.
Yeah, but in a good way, and I think that's an important point you make, Neil. He, for example, he courted controversy on the right at times when he, so to speak, excommunicated the John Birchers from the conservative movement. They were powerful then in 62, 63, and he devoted, I think, much of an issue to National Review to denounce them and to sort of save conservatism from a taint of extremism and sort of kookiness. He denounced anti-Semitism on the right, and I think he took almost a whole issue and devoted it to that in 1990 or 1991 when there was a bit of a resurgence of that. So he was, you know, for all that he was a sort of fun-loving troublemaker and challenger of orthodoxy, he was very concerned, ultimately, that conservatism be intellectually and politically serious, and he contributed a lot to making it a governing movement, a potentially governing movement, or at least sometimes governing movement in America.
Let's get Barbara on the line. Barbara's calling us from Tallahassee in Florida.
Hello.
Hi, Barbara. Go ahead, please.
In 1970, my mother was retired from her own business. She was owned her own business, and she wrote to Bill Buckley because she was on Social Security, and she wanted his book, Inveighing, We Will Go, but she couldn't quite afford it on Social Security, so he sent her a signed copy, and I have it to this day. But we adored Bill Buckley, and this morning when he died, I said the cherubim and the seraphim are going to be waiting for him.
Thanks very much for the call, Barbara.
Okay.
He was personally a very generous man. I mean, this is obviously sending a book is a minor, though act of generosity, though I'm sure important to the woman who received it. But I mean, he was generous in terms of friendship and monetarily, financially generous in terms of supporting institutions and causes, but also personally charitable and generous, really, in terms of bringing along younger writers. So many people began at National Review. I was just talking with David Brooks on the phone, and he reminded me, you know, who's going to write. I was making sure he was going to. He'll have his column in the New York Times Friday.
You both have columns in the New York Times, yes.
Yeah, and he'll write about Bill on Friday, I think, in the Times. And he reminded me, I'd forgotten this, that he started as an intern at National Review way back when he was in college. And the reason Buckley found out about him is that he had written, I think, a satire of Bill Buckley in the University of Chicago college paper when he was a freshman or a sophomore. Buckley, I think, was coming to Chicago to speak. Someone gave him the paper. He was so amused by it that he met Brooks and asked him as a 19-year-old to come work at National Review in New York for the summer.
Let's get Peter on the line. Peter with us from Berkeley in California.
Hi. Well, first of all, I want to compliment the NPR reporter that did the piece this morning on Buckley and said the silky manners and skewering intellect of William F. Buckley, Jr. What a wonderful juxtaposition of phrase, and he would have loved it, I think. But I picked up his book, Miles Gone By, and he has a wonderful part in it about sailing and what it's like to be out in the middle of the Pacific looking up at the stars, and you've packed all the things and the candy bars, and there you are, and you could just as easily go somewhere totally different, to South America or to Alaska. And that was the essence of freedom, and he captured it by telling that story. And it's just lovely. It's on page 238 of his book, Miles Gone By, about sailing.
And just to credit the source of that quote you gave earlier, that was Netta Ullaby who came up
with
that.
Oh, thank you. And thank her.
And thank you very much for the call, Peter. And Bill Kristol, of course, we remember that skewering intellect for sure and the charm we've spoken about. But yes, transoceanic sailor, harpsichordist, a man who led a rich life.
No, absolutely. I mean, Bill taught many things about politics, about culture, about ideas. But one of the things he taught was that you shouldn't actually spend 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, devoting yourself to politics and to political fighting or even to intellectual fighting. And he sailed. I guess he was kind of a world-class sailor. He skied. He had friendships of all kinds all over the world. He was a terrific harpsichordist. I heard him play in his home, and he was, it was all way above my level. I can't judge, but he seemed to me to be virtually a kind of, concert quality harpsichordist with a great knowledge of Bach in particular. Bach was his favorite, and I remember once hearing an argument between Bill and someone else about Bach versus Mozart that was a very impressive and good-natured argument of that sort. So he really lived life to the full.
NPR listeners may remember he went on Piano Jazz to play harpsichord with Marion McPartland. So that's tough company, and he more than held his own. So, but a novelist, too. He wrote thrillers based on a CIA agent who, I think, in the first book, goes to bed with the Queen of England.
Yeah, I remember reading those when I was younger, and I think he tossed those off very quickly, and they were very amusing, and they often had they were based on historical incidents. I don't know about that one, or historical moments, when they would capture that in an interesting and educational way.
We're talking with Bill Kristol, the founder and editor of the Weekly Standard and a columnist for the New York Times, about his friend and, I guess, to some degree, mentor, Bill Buckley, who died earlier today. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Phil on the line. Phil calling us from Jacksonville in Florida. Phil, you there?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to remind everybody of a certain age about Gore Vidal and Bill Buckley appearing on TV, and I was just always blown away that, like Johnny Carson would have him on, and the intellectual battles that they used to fight there in front of the audience late at night.
We don't think of The Tonight Show as much of a forum for intellectual discussion these days, do we, Bill Kristol?
Well, no, you don't, and when you think back on that, it's pretty amazing, and you just can't imagine it being on any type of prime time.
Well, but Bill was made himself really a celebrity and did that, I think, somewhat self-consciously. He didn't like the outward accoutrements of celebrity, I wouldn't say, but I think he thought it was important actually to the ideas and principles he believed in there. That sort of, in America, you need to, a political and cultural movement needs a leader, and Bill wasn't, he used television as well as obviously the printed word above all to advance his ideas. He was a guest, as the caller said, on Johnny Carson and such. He also started Firing Line way back in, I think, the late 60s, which was on public television for 30 years. I actually had the honor to be on the last Firing Line he did, which I think was in 1998 or 99, something like that. And that was on for 30 years. And I remember this for generations of, especially younger people, I think, watching a sort of civilized and witty debate with Bill sort of holding forth. Really was a kind of introduction to conservatism. That it's one thing to read a magazine, but just to see him in action and sort of in real time, being so knowledgeable and so urbane, it was really, I think he attracted an awful lot of people to conservatism who might not have made it there if they just had had to pick up the magazine or the books.
Phil, thanks for the call. Let's go now to, this is Lawrence. Lawrence with us from Grand Rapids in Michigan.
Hello.
Hi, Lawrence. Go ahead, please.
I just wanted to comment about his skewering intellect and charm and fun-loving nature, but kind of on the other side where ultimately, if he was a leader, below it all was a Darwinian capitalist. And as someone who had great influence, and I guess still does, that attitude, looking at the two Americas that we frequently talk about, and the rich and the poor, I'm sure he had a great personality, but kind of ignored or said that life is basically Darwinian capitalism. And I think that ultimately was probably not a positive thing.
Bill Kristol?
Yeah, I don't agree. I mean, Bill believed in free markets, and he believed that ultimately the poor would be helped more by free markets and competition and breaking up government monopolies, just school choice, for example, and public schools. But I would say he was not a Darwinian. I mean, he in fact, published a famous withering review by Whitaker Chambers in the late 50s of Ayn Rand. He offended a lot of his readers who loved the novels of Ayn Rand. But Chambers said this is not a sufficient vision for conservatism or for life, you know, this kind of pure Darwinianism, you might say, Darwinism. And Buckley, of course, was a very serious Catholic, wrote very movingly about his Catholic faith. So people can obviously agree or disagree with his different policy views and the balance he found between his, for example, his preference for markets and his belief in Catholic social teaching. But he was a complicated thinker. I mean, one of the things that's important about Buckley is he tried to bring together lots of different strands of conservatism, ranging from religious to sort of economics. Of course, very strong foreign policy, as you had in your opening segment when you talked to him in 2004. I do think the anti-communism and the faith in freedom at home, the defense of freedom at home, and where possible, the defense of freedom abroad, that perhaps was the most important aspect of the movement he founded. But
and I just wanted to read this email from Anne in Washington State. I used to watch Firing Line, and though I would rarely agree with Mr. Buckley, I enjoyed listening to him argue his case, and unlike the current batch of conservative talk show hosts, he wasn't afraid to invite formidable opponents on his show and allow them to present their case. And I don't remember ever seeing him shout people down. Weirdly, I will miss him. I think we all will. Bill Kristol, thanks very much for your time today.
My pleasure.
Bill Kristol, a columnist for the New York Times and the founder of the Weekly Standard. Again, more on the death of William F. Buckley later today on All Things Considered. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.